and that the two of them had gone through some tough times. We talked about everything. At the time, I had been reading Noam Chomsky and listening to Amy Goodman on the radio program Democracy Now. Rick and Barb were 52, and I was 26. Politically, we were two very different breeds, but he told me that we're all human, that there's so much messed up stuff going on, we need to hold on to what we love. We ran for 2 hours. Every step of the way, I knew exactly where I was. I was running the path. Word had gotten out that I had run the second half of the Western States with a blown ankle, and Jeff Dean told me that the victory there elevated me from cult figure to legend. He said he didn't know if he'd be able to come up with another name if I won a fourth time. I aimed to find out. Breathing. Breathing is critical, no matter what you're doing, whether it be meditation, calculus, or boxing. Beginning fighters first learn how to breathe so that they don't exhaust themselves by panting. One of the most important things you can do as an ultra runner is to breathe abdominally, and a good way to learn that skill is to practice nasal breathing. Lying on your back, place a book on your stomach. Breathe in and out through your nose, and try to make your stomach rise and fall with each breath. When you succeed in doing so, you're breathing from your diaphragm rather than your chest, which allows you to breathe more deeply and efficiently. Once you've mastered that, try nasal breathing, in and out through the nose, while you're running easy routes. For more difficult runs, like hills and tempo workouts, breathe in through the nose, then exhale forcefully through the mouth, akin to what yoga practitioners call breath of fire. Eventually, you should be able to breathe through your nose for entire easy runs and inhale nasally during the less strenuous sections of even 100-mile runs. I experimented with nasal breathing when I was training for the Western States 100, and it helped me become more of an abdominal runner. Nasal breathing humidifies and cleans the air. As a bonus, it allows you to eat quickly and breathe at the same time, whether running easy or hard. Chapter 13 of Bears and Gazelles. Western States 100, 2002 and 2003. A quote from Dogen Roshi. Don't work towards freedom, but allow the work itself to be freedom. I knew my fourth try was going to be brutal. It was 105 degrees, I had a touch of the flu, and I was sure people were talking about me the way I had talked about Tweetmeyer. The world was filled with guys like Rickliffs. I had been a guy like that. Maybe the past year, someone had been holed up in a basement apartment on the outskirts of Seattle, emerging at night only to run Mount Si back to back to back to back. Maybe that guy was faster than me, stronger. Maybe he was a better athlete. If I thought biology was destiny, I would have given up a long time ago. I've got scoliosis, my left foot toes out, and I had high blood pressure in elementary school, and my marathon time of 2:38 is nothing special. My height is a mixed blessing. Good for stride length, bad for heat and technical trails, which makes my brain that much more important. In a sprint, if you don't have perfect form, you're doomed. The ultra distance forgives injury, fatigue, bad form, and illness. A bear with determination will defeat a dreamy gazelle every time. I can't count the number of times people have said, "I can't believe he beat me." Distance strips you bare. So what if other bodies might be stronger? I would use my mind. Bushido. I want to make everyone work hard, I told a reporter before the race. I want to make them hurt. I loved ultra running, and I loved ultra runners, but even a super polite vegan could be a dick during competition, sometimes even to a friend. Dave Terry, the world-class projectile vomiter, was running on my shoulder by mile 15 of the Western States. 3 years had passed since I'd first rolled to the finish line, and Dave and I had become pals. I had grown to admire his work ethic and the way he went out of the way to show kindness to everyone he met. Dave was a solid runner, often in the top three, but seldom a winner. He never let his frustration boil into anything like rudeness. What was most striking was the way he seemed to understand someone's sadness before it was even mentioned. Dave always had a few wise words of encouragement to share, especially, it seemed, to those who needed them most. "Hey, Scott," Dave said as he pulled alongside. "Such a sweet guy." I smiled. "Hey, Dave," I said in the tone of voice I might have used if we had been sharing a beer at his kitchen table or discussing plans for a Saturday night movie. And then, before he could answer, I said, "What are you doing up here? You must really want to hurt today." Then I took off. No one called me Flatlander anymore. No one opined, at least in my presence, that I was going out too fast or that Tweetmeyer or anyone else was going to reel me in. When I wasn't leading, I reeled others in. It wasn't just competitors who were treating me differently. People came into the store just to ask me questions about what I ate, how I trained, and what shoes I liked. I had sponsorship deals from various footwear, clothing, and energy bar manufacturers, but that only covered travel expenses, not necessarily lodging or food. It was all because I could run far, fast, and I could do that, I was convinced, because of what I was eating. I stopped the raw diet right after my 2001 Western States victory. The extra time involved in chewing was too much. I'm serious. That, combined with my concern about getting enough calories, drew me back to cooking. But I kept a lot of what I had learned. The smoothies, a large salad for lunch, paying attention to ingredients and preparation. Eating raw was like getting a PhD in a plant-based diet. Hard work, but worth it. At the same time, due to losing a food sponsor, I started making my own gels. I mixed brown rice syrup with blueberries or cocoa powder and made it in bulk. I also experimented with Kalamata olives and hummus on whole wheat tortillas for long runs. My blood pressure and triglyceride levels dropped to all-time lows. My HDL, good cholesterol, shot up to an all-time high. I had virtually no joint inflammation, even after miles of pounding trails and roads, and on the rare occasions I sprained an ankle or fell and whacked my elbow or knee, the soreness left faster than it ever had before. Was it the fiber that sped food through my digestive tract, minimizing the impact of toxins? Was it the food I was adding? The vitamins and minerals, the lycopene, lutein, and beta-carotene? Almost every day, a new micronutrient is discovered in plant foods that offers protective effects against disease. Or was it what I wasn't eating? The concentrated carcinogens, excess protein, refined carbohydrates, trans fats? Factory-farmed animals are treated with growth hormones and steroids to encourage their rapid transit from birth to slaughterhouse. If we wouldn't take steroids ourselves, or eat a bowl of transgenic pesticide-soaked soybeans, why would we eat the flesh of an animal that has? Or was the sum of a plant-based diet greater than its parts? Vegetarians are likely to have healthy habits outside the kitchen, as well as more active lifestyles and less smoking. A major study shows that vegetarians watch less television, smoke less, and sleep more per night than meat eaters. I wasn't sure of the answer, but my diet seemed to be working. So when I came across naysayers, and there were plenty, I weighed my experience against their theories. When I read Eat Right for Your Type by Peter Diadamo right before my first Western States and learned that my blood type, O, was the least suited of all types to vegetarianism, I worried a little, but not too much. According to Diadamo, my ancestral profile made me a canny, aggressive predator who preferred baby seal meat to bean burritos. But those burritos had fueled me through that first Western States as well as two others. I wasn't the only one who didn't go along with matching diet to blood type. Dr. Frederick Stare, founder of the nutritional department at the Harvard School of Public Health, called this book not only one of the most preposterous books in the market, but also one of the most frightening. It contains just enough scientific-sounding nonsense, carefully woven into a complex theory to actually seem convincing to the uninitiated. I maintained my smoothie habit. I made more friends at farmers' markets. I soaked beans, baked bread, rolled oats. I entered other races, searched for new training routes. Even though I knew the western states would be more challenging than ever, I was confident. Before the race, Dusty had bet an old friend of his in Minnesota, Rod Raymond, one of the standout endurance athletes of Duluth, that I would win a fourth consecutive western states. Rod took the bet. If Dusty lost, he would have to landscape the Raymond's front yard, a job worth $2,000. But if Dusty and I won, Rod had to give Dusty his 1984 Suzuki Tempter motorcycle. The race was tough, but not close. The last 20 miles, Dusty ran beside me repeating over and over, "Vroom, vroom, come on, jerker, gotta get my motorcycle." Later, Dusty called Rod and got his voicemail. He yelled into his cell phone, "You owe me a motorcycle, bitch!" I won a fifth Western States in 2003 in 16 hours, 1 minute. Another 20 minutes faster, an ultra running magazine called it Performance of the Year. During that race, Dusty, behind me, screamed something as we were descending a dried creek drainage, heading to the American River, but I didn't pay attention. It was 72 miles in, and I was gliding effortlessly. "Dude," he said, "do you realize you just stepped on a rattlesnake back there?" That was the race when Tonto died. He had been spending the week with Dusty and me, running every day. During the race, Tonto stayed at my friend Shannon Wiles' ranch, which was on the course. I saw Tonto at mile 55 when I passed the ranch. The next morning, after I had won, Shannon called to tell me Tonto was gone. After the award ceremony, Dusty, Scott McCoubry, and another friend and runner named Brandon Sabrowski helped me bury Tonto just outside of Michigan Bluff, right next to the Western States Trail. I won again the next year, in 2004. And set a new record of 15 hours, 36 minutes. 9 minutes, 22 second per mile pace, earning another Ultra Runner of the Year honor and, more importantly, accomplishing what I had set out to do 6 years earlier. Brooks Sports hired me that year to work with their design team on a new trail shoe called the Cascadia and to do presentations and store appearances. In 2005, I won a 7th consecutive Western States, something no man had done before or since. I also trimmed off 14 inches of my hair to donate to Locks of Love for children with cancer. It was no big ceremony, but it felt better than any other haircut I had ever received. I treasured those races, but just as much I treasured the weeks before the competition. The local press sought out Dusty, and he always had a quote ready. In 2003, the Auburn Journal accidentally ran Dusty on the front page with the caption, "Scott Jurek, 5-time winner of WS100. We laughed about it, and even had him go up at first to accept my award. The WS board wasn't happy, but we loved it. At night, at the campsite, Dusty and I had set up in the Sierra Nevada mountains. The temperature would drop into the 30s, and before turning in, we'd look at the sky. Neither of us talked about the way Dusty had inspired me to run, or the success that accrued to me because of that running. We didn't talk about how being with each other was in many ways an escape for both of us. For Dusty, those weeks took him away from his peripatetic life, his wanderings in Minnesota and Colorado, chasing snowflakes and trying to eke out a living through odd carpentry jobs. For me, it was a refuge from a life of responsibilities I had never anticipated. Not even 10 years earlier, I had been trudging snowmobile trails, dreaming big and spending big. I had planned on running hard, counted on winning. What I hadn't anticipated were sponsorships with Brooks, ProTech, and Clif Bar, delivering presentations and attending trade shows in between races. But, as I had discovered, those were flags on the path of ultra running, markers on the path Hippie Dan had urged me to find. Or were they warning signs? I didn't know. I wanted more. I wanted to push myself, to crack myself open and discover something fresh. I wanted a new challenge. Chapter 14. A Hot Mess. Badwater Ultra Marathon, 2005. A Japanese proverb. Fall down 7 times. Get up 8. On August 3rd, 1977, the hottest day of that year, a 50-year-old named Al Arnold tried to run from Badwater, California, through and across Death Valley to the summit of 14,000-foot Mount Whitney. 6'5" and 200 pounds, he had tried the feat twice before, failing both times. This effort would be his last. He succeeded, and thus was born the Badwater Ultramarathon, and said, regarding the last 40 miles or so, it was like all tranquility that can exist existed for me. He said that the photographs taken of him after mile 100 show an unearthly glow coming off his body. Today, the 135-mile course starts in Death Valley at 280 feet below sea level and arrows on a paved road straight to the portal of Mount Whitney at 8,300 feet. It was the crazy race Rick Miller had told me about 4 years earlier. The Badwater Ultramarathon, or simply the Badwater, is big overseas and has been the subject of more than one documentary film. Part of the reason is the race director, Chris Kostman, is something of a publicity genius. The press material calls it the world's toughest foot race, which I seriously doubted, as it was on all roads, and for ultra runners, relatively level. Most untough of all, the cutoff time was 60 hours. You could walk the thing and finish. I had run in hot weather before at the Western States. I had climbed and descended 10,500 feet on my training runs in the 12 Peaks. I caused despair in others, not the other way around. So the Badwater didn't scare me, but it did intrigue me. It was not as obviously difficult as other events I had won, but there was something perversely challenging about it. I aimed to find out what. Most serious runners wait at least a month between ultras, but less than a week after winning my 7th Western States, I flew to Las Vegas. A lot of people said I was crazy to enter another race, especially this race, especially so soon. When I arrived in Death Valley, I took a training run that singed my nose hairs. I felt as if a branding iron were pressed on my skull from the inside. I drove to a Home Depot and purchased an industrial-strength sprayer. I helped Rick and Barb Miller rig up a coffin-sized cooler which would be filled with ice water. I had, of course, asked Dusty to pace me. When he felt the heat, he said he would do it only if I promised to take him to Las Vegas for a few days afterwards, strippers included. My main competition would be last year's second-place finisher, a Canadian baggage handler named Ferg Hawk, who said things like, "The first half of the Badwater is run with the legs, the second half with the heart." He sounded interesting. Not a threat, but interesting. There was another guy, a 50-year-old named Mike Sweeney. He had brought vests of synthetic ice packets that he had duct-taped together. He had also stored, on dry ice, small Tupperware bowls inside larger Tupperware bowls, anchored by an inch-thick layer of ice between the two. He planned to wear the device, he had 3, on his head, duct-taped around his chin. Sweeney dove off cliffs for fun and smacked his head a lot. He said it made him and his skull stronger. Also competing would be a trio of large German men wearing floppy garden hats, who, recognizing me before the race, chanted, "We will overtake you!" Ultramarathons tend to attract obsessive people. To undertake a race of over 50 miles requires training that can occupy 3 hours a day, a routine that involves cramps and pain and loneliness, not to mention the inevitable moments of doubt and maybe even a little self-loathing. Ultras seem to attract seekers of all kinds, including recovering addicts and alcoholics, seers, sages, some very wacky engineers, and poets, and assorted windmill tilters. Not to mention the monks and holy men. Consider Sri Chinmoy, who, after arriving in New York City in 1964, taught meditation and a lifestyle of personal transformation in which athletics featured heavily. He attracted thousands of followers, among them Carlos Santana and Carl Lewis, and maintained a center in Queens. He demanded that his followers practice celibacy and vegetarianism and abstain from drugs, alcohol, and smoking. Many of them worked for Chinmoy in his associated businesses, such as the Smile of the Beyond Luncheonette in Jamaica and the Oneness Fountain Heart in Flushing. The Sri Chinmoy Marathon Team, founded in 1977, has gone on to promote and compete in numerous ultras. The most famous is the 3,100-mile self-transcendence race, the longest foot race in the world, held on a city block in Queens. 164th place to Abigail Adams Avenue to 168th Street to Grand Central Parkway. The 3,100-mile distance honors the year 31 of Sri Chinmoy's birth. Runners must compete 5,649 laps of the .5488-mile course in 52 days, extended to 54 in 2011 due to extreme heat. It is tantamount to running two marathons a day. Many run for 17 or 18 hours a day. The experience is so grueling and repetitive that few even undertake, much less complete, the race. In 2011, 10 runners competed and 8 finished. But the most famous and infamous contemporary band of alleged spiritual long-distance runners is probably the group known as Divine Madness. Members make a monthly financial commitment to the group. Its founder and leader, Mark Tizer, a.k.a. Yo, encourages communal living, ultra-running, and free love. He will tack on extra miles in the middle of the group's training runs to keep them adaptable. He has runners hold out their arm, and he presses against it, then diagnoses their problems, what kind of running shoes they need, and who they should sleep with. They eat and sleep on the floor and work at subsistence jobs. Two former members of the group filed a civil lawsuit against Yo in 1996, joined in 1997 by a third, alleging mind control through sleep deprivation, fasting, and isolation. The case was settled out of court. One woman lodged a sexual assault case with the police. Mark Heinemann was an apparently healthy group member who dropped dead of pneumonia after a 48-hour race. He was 46. Mike Sweeney passed me at mile 15, but I wasn't worried. Even if he hadn't been a head-smacking, ice-helmet-wearing cliff diver, I wouldn't have been worried. I was looking forward to the uphill at 40 miles. That's when I would reel him in. That's when I would claim the Badwater as mine. A few miles later, I dropped from second to fourth place. Ferg had passed me, and a guy I never heard of named Chris Berglund did, too. I felt as if I might puke. One of my crew members said to slow it down, to take it easy, but I was getting my ass kicked by a bunch of underdogs. I was hearing reports that Sweeney was ahead by 25 minutes. It was the heat. My training runs had helped, but nothing could have helped me enough for this. Imagine a sun so pitiless that it seemed to want to personally torture you. Imagine that every time you inhaled, the air was so hot that it seared your already parched throat and stung your lungs. Now imagine that a tall, cool, ice bottle of water was waiting for you, along with an aquamarine swimming pool and giant puddles of shade under oversized umbrellas, and that fans were wafting cool breezes your way as you lay down on crisp, chilly sheets. Now, imagine that all that relief was only another 110 miles away, and you had to run there, through heat every bit as awful as what you just endured. Maybe worse. I ran, mostly uphill, to the aid station at Stovepipe Wells, 20 miles away, where my crew had prepared the giant coffin cooler. Dusty was jumping up and down in the parking lot, barefoot, wearing a black down expedition jacket, shouting, "Hot potato! Hot potato!" He was doing it to amuse me, I'm sure, to take my mind off the difficulties ahead. If I hadn't felt like my internal organs were liquefying, I might have chuckled. I took off my sun pants and long-sleeved sun shirt, both specially designed by Brooks, and wriggled in. I thought I heard my crew discussing Sweeney's lead, and I remember thinking that I should get out. That if, sometimes you just do things, then that moment would certainly be an auspicious time to start. My body thought otherwise. I don't think I've ever felt so good. Dusty suggested it was time to go, but I demurred. When, finally, I climbed out, I wanted to immediately climb back in. After 2 miles, I told my crew I needed it again. 2 more miles, one of them said, but they drove 3 miles. When I arrived, I told them I was ready, but again they said 2 more miles, and again they drove 3 miles. Rick Miller told me to stop thinking about the giant cooler, and he sprayed me down with a contraption I had bought at Home Depot. There's something profoundly lonely about any ultra, but the Badwater is the loneliest of all. Ancient sand dunes roll over the valley floor like waves. Huge boulders lounge in the middle of emptiness. The salt flat shimmers and beckons with its treacherous beauty. The wonderful thing about ultramarathons is that, no matter how awful things get, how searing the pain you're in, there's always a chance to redeem yourself. If you're willing to work, salvation awaits. Sweeney was still a good 5 miles ahead, and I had 10 miles to go before I got to the top of Towns Pass, mile 59 of the race. Those 10 miles, with their choking heat and blowing dust and the murderous incline and altitude, were popular among automakers. They used the stretch to test their latest models for performance under rigorous conditions. It had gotten too hot even for the desert rat Rick Miller, so Dusty joined me and ran me up the next 10 miles. "You the man. Yeah, brother, that's how you do it, jerker. Hell yeah," the dust ball hollered. We crested the pass just as the sun set. Dusty peeled into the twilight to get some rest for the night shift, and my friend Justin Angle took over. I learned how to run downhill on Mount Si, and I put those lessons to use on the descent to Panamint Valley. I felt as if I was floating. I flew by Ferg and yelled, "Free speed!" I found out later that I was clocking 5-minute miles. I blazed into the valley at dark. Night had not just fallen, it had thudded and crashed, and the air had cooled to 105 degrees. But that was all right, because out of the blackness jogged the jester of the dark, the rogue prince of the cake-eaters. We blazed into the night. We might as well have been back on the game trails of Duluth. What could go wrong? I found out at mile 70. 1 minute I was flying, the next I was dying. I started looking for a sidewinder in the desert. If one bit me, I could quit without shame. Ferg passed me, a few miles out of Panamint Springs. I sat by the side of the road. Then I puked, and puked some more. My crew joined me. They told me to put my feet in the air, and my crew moved me to the desert side of the van so Ferg's crew, who were always sneaking up on me or back to me to see where I was or how much Ferg needed to worry, couldn't learn anything. Lee and Barb and Rick huddled over me, telling me I had beat longer odds, that I had run tougher races. I was dry heaving. I heard a voice say, "I don't think this is gonna happen." And I realized it was my voice. I had studied enough nutrition and physical therapy to know that what was happening should not have been happening. In some ways, an ultra isn't even as hard as a marathon. My heart rate was lower, and my lungs were less taxed than they would have been during a shorter, faster race. Sure, most marathons don't go through the heart of Death Valley, but I had done my homework on that front, so my body should have been primed. All those runs through the heat at Rick and Barb's had made my sweating and circulation more efficient. The time spent training in altitude had sparked adaptations such as an increased network of capillaries, bigger energy-producing mitochondria, and elevated levels of the enzyme 2,3-diphosphoglycerate to help oxygen reach my tissues. The body's ability to adapt is truly astounding. That's why I say that with the right training and support, anyone can do an ultra. Yet, there's a reason why top marathoners aren't flocking to the sport, and it's not just the lack of cash and prizes. Although the pace of an ultra is slower, maintaining that effort for hours and hours can leave the best of us huddled at the side of the road, dry heaving. For one thing, there's a cumulative loading on the muscles and bones. Every time the foot hits the ground, the quadriceps and calf muscles have to lengthen to absorb the shock of the impact, and that adds up when you go 100 miles, whether you're barefoot or in Brooks, running or walking, slapping your heel or landing on your toes. Downhills are the worst of all. When you see runners shuffling across the Badwater finish line, it's not because they're too tired to push off. It's because they're too sore to land. Even if you're able to keep food down under these conditions, you'll eventually hit the famous wall, where the glycogen energy stores in your liver and muscles are depleted. In a marathon, the wall comes at the tail end of the race, but in an ultra, it's not even at the midpoint, and it happens many times. You'll have to spend hours in the catabolic state where your body is forced to burn fat, protein, and even its own muscles to ensure adequate energy reaches the brain. A cascade of stress-related hormones floods the body in response to the sustained exertion. Blood tests after ultras have shown elevated cardiac enzymes, renal injury, and very high levels of the stress hormone cortisol, the pro-inflammatory compound interleukin-6, and creatine kinase, a toxic byproduct of muscle breakdown. That's a lot for the immune system to handle. Approximately 1 in 4 runners at the Western States gets a cold after the race, and this is in the height of summer. Most of all, the ultra distance leaves you alone with your thoughts to an excruciating extent. Whatever song you have in your head had better be a good one. Whatever story you are telling yourself had better be a story about going on. There is no room for negativity. The reason most people quit has nothing to do with their body. Was my mind failing me? Could I have done something differently? You're not gonna win this fucking race lying down in the dirt. Come on, jerker, get the fuck up. I got up, tried to run, and almost fell. Come on, jerker, Dusty said. We're just gonna walk. We're just gonna take a little walk in the desert. We walked, and after a little while, Dusty said, Let's run 20 feet. It'll be just like Nordic ski training. It'll be like ski walking. He said walking, imitating our old Russian coach, and I couldn't stop chuckling, but I managed a sip of water. Sweeney was miles ahead. I couldn't even catch the crazy Canadian. What was I doing? I might have said this to Dusty. We'll just take this piece by piece, he said. Piece by piece. I forgot about catching anyone. I forgot about finishing. I forgot about everything except making it up the next switchback. Dusty saw the expression on my face. He told me this wasn't life and death. I didn't need to kill myself. Piece by piece, switchback by switchback, we crested a lonely hummock, freckled with Joshua trees. My stomach felt better. I started to run. Dusty started to run. I picked up speed. So did the dust ball. Rhythm and form, Jerker. Rhythm and form. Come on. Stretch it out. Come on, you wanna fucking be somebody? Let's do this. We ran. I had traveled 85 miles. We ran over a rolling plateau on the border of Death Valley National Park. A crew member told us Furrick had passed Sweeney and that the cliff diver was cracking. Dusty and I flew. We ticked off an 8-minute mile, then a 7.5-minute mile, then another 7.5. I felt as if I could run forever. If you're an athlete and you're fortunate, you felt it. Being in the zone, tasting Satori, the sudden zen-like clarity that comes when you least expect it, often when your body is pushed to the limit. Running backs speak of the game slowing down until all the other players are moving with almost cartoonish sluggishness as the running back in the zone darts among and between them. Basketball players testify that the hoop at which they are shooting not only seems larger, but is larger. Runners speak of feeling absorbed into the universe, of seeing the story of life in a single weed on the side of the road. When I've been lucky enough to feel it, the sensation is one of effortlessness. It occurs when the intensity of the race, the pressure to win, the pain, build to a level that's nearly unbearable. Then something opens up inside me. I find the part of me that is bigger than the pain. Satori can be sought, but it cannot be held. A few strides after an epic feeling of bliss, I'll get an ache in my knees, or the urge to pee, or I'll start worrying about how the person I'm chasing down is feeling. I can't beat back those feelings or desires, but I know they're not what really matters. What matters is the place of effortlessness, of selflessness. There might be many paths to that magical region. Prayer and meditation come to mind. My way leads up to and past the point of absolute, maximal effort. It's only when I get to a place where all my physical and psychological warning lights are flashing red, and then run beyond it, that I hit the sweet spot. I know people who get there on a 5-mile jog or by mindfully chopping a carrot. I've traveled to the zone myself by those activities. In an ultramarathon, though, the trip to the zone isn't a luxury. It's almost a given. At 12:30, I had stopped floating. Where was Mike? At 1 a.m., surrounded by the stunted Joshua trees under a moonless, starry sky, Dusty and I heard him. He was gasping and moaning. The vest had not only melted, but had dragged at Mike with its 20 pounds of dead weight. The ice helmets had been too cold to wear. Mike's pace had been suicidal. He was suffering from hyponatremia, drinking too much water combined with his kidneys' failure to expel enough from his body. He was stumbling, and his face looked swollen. His sodium levels were plummeting. As we passed, I saw the expression on Mike's face. There's no way he should have been standing, much less moving forward. I gained a lot of respect for Mike that night. I gained a lot of respect for Badwater. Dusty and I passed Ferg at 90 miles, and he passed us a 30 miles later. Sorry, Scott, he said. I have to do this for the folks back in Canada. I hadn't actually raced this late in an ultra since dueling Ben Hyen and Tommy Nielsen at Angeles Crest. For more than 5 years, when an ultra was 80 miles old, I had already won. Not this time. I added Ferg Hawk to the list of ultra runners who had earned my respect. A few minutes later, I passed him again. This time for good. I ran through the dried bed of Owens Lake at sunrise with my best friend, and as the darkness clicked to red and brown, Dusty slowed down and shuffled off to a shadowy pickup truck to do what only the patron saint of wild men knew. I ran to Lone Pine, where the deer flies came out, and toward Mount Whitney, and I ran past the 100-mile mark, farther than I had ever run before. A legend, known as Badwater Ben, sat in a car and watched me run. 14 years earlier, he had been running the Badwater when he came upon a body. He had interrupted his race to perform an autopsy. I learned later that when Badwater Ben saw me running and gauged my speed and the distance I had come, he had remarked to his companion in the car that he was worried. I crossed the finish line, 135 miles from where I had started, after 24 hours and 36 minutes. No one had ever run it faster, nor had anybody won the Western States 100 and the Badwater 135 a mere 2 weeks apart. When it was done, I sat in the pine needles, and I thought about my mother, who would never walk, and my father, who had never seen me run. I thought of the coaches who had helped me, the runners and writers who had inspired me. I thought of my wife and my best friend, who, even though they seldom spoke to each other anymore, had both supported me. "Hey, jerker!" It was Dusty, as usual, dragging me from my reveries. "When are we going to Vegas? When are we going to see the strippers? You fucking promised!" Finding the time. If you're going to run regularly, you're going to need to carve out part of your day, even if it's 30 to 60 minutes. If that seems impossible, ask yourself, how much time do I spend watching television or surfing the internet or shopping? Take some of that time and devote it to doing something good for yourself. If you're still in a bind, double up on activities. Run to work and back. Many companies have become increasingly helpful to employees who want to exercise, providing showers, changing rooms, and sometimes even incentives. They realize that a fit worker will incur fewer health costs. Run to work and get a ride home. Run to the grocery store and have someone pick you up. Combine errands, running from place to place, and you'll get a workout in while you're taking care of business. And if you're already working out regularly, you'll be that much more fit. Chapter 15. These guys again? Copper Canyon Ultra Marathon, 2006. A Raramuri proverb. When you run on the earth and with the earth, you can run forever. The email had shown up on my screen in mid-2005. It was from someone named Caballo Blanco, which in Spanish means white horse. I learned later that Caballo had formerly been known as Micah True, and that he had been a boxer, itinerant furniture mover, and distance running sage. But when he emailed me, all I knew is that he had been following my career, and that he had a proposition. He lived in an adobe hut dug into the side of a deep, hidden canyon in Mexico. Nearby lived a group of indigenous Indians called the Raramuri, or Running People, also known as the Tarahumara. He said they were the greatest runners on earth. He wanted me to participate in an epic 50-mile race he had set up in the canyon. One of the world's greatest runners, me, against the world's greatest runners, with a prize of 1,000 pounds of corn and $750. I remembered the tribe. The Tarahumara were the middle-aged guys in togas who smoked cigarettes before the Angeles Crest 100 and couldn't run downhill. The greatest runners on earth? I liked to travel, and I liked exploring different cultures, and the guys in the togas had always interested me. But the trip would have messed up my schedule. I was training for the Austin Marathon, and running a 50-miler immediately afterward didn't make sense. I didn't speak Spanish, and I didn't know how I'd get down there. Plus, it's not as if it was a big challenge. I'd already beat the Indians. Caballo wrote that the Tarahumara he knew were nothing like the ones I had bested at the Angeles Crest 100. He also said that he sensed in me a purity of spirit similar to that of the running Indians. He said that the Tarahumara were struggling to survive under difficult circumstances, and that if a runner from the United States visited, it might help. I wrote back that I'd love to support the plight of the Tarahumara, but I wasn't going to be able to make it. That was a mistake. A few days later, I got another email from Caballo. The plight? The Tarahumara don't have a fucking plight. They don't need your help. I thought, wow, this guy is really out there. And I forgot about it. But I kept getting emails from him, talking about the mystical running Indians of the Hidden Copper Canyon and how they knew things the rest of the world didn't. If I could figure out a way to get down there, I might go. Then the universe figured it out for me. I got another email invitation, this one from a writer named Chris McDougall. He said he was working on a book about the Indian runners, and that he was fluent in Spanish. He, too, promised that the Tarahumara would give me a good race. I agreed, but not because I need another good race. I found plenty of those. I raced the White River 50-miler, the Miwok 100K, the Way Too Cool 50K, the grueling Wasatch Front 100, and on the East Coast, the Mountain Masochist 50-miler and the Vermont 100. I was on the winning teams in Japan's Hasegawa Cup and in the Hong Kong Trail Walker, where we set a new course record. I had my own physical therapy practice, my own coaching business, was working 50-plus hours a week and still just scraping by, and had started a running camp a few weeks before the Western States, where I tried to share what I knew about technique and will. At my camp, I served hearty vegan meals. I was making a living doing something I loved. I was teaching others. Had running ever given anyone more? My problem was, I wanted more. My bigger problem? I wasn't exactly sure what more I wanted. I told McDougall I would meet him in El Paso. There were 9 of us. McDougall and his coach Eric Orton, Caballo, me, a pair of wild rookie ultra runners from Virginia, Jen Shelton and Billy Bartnett, a man named Ted McDonald, who called himself Barefoot Ted because he recently started jogging without shoes, my buddy and photographer Luis Escobar and his father. Caballo told us the race would start from the village of Urique. To get there, we'd have to hike 35 miles over a series of knife-edged canyon ridges through land where entrepreneurs with small armies and automatic weapons harvested marijuana, over an invisible route that no one but the guy who lived in the mud hut really knew. Caballo mentioned that a group of Tarahumara might join us. We hiked for 3 hours, but we didn't see any Rarámuri. Caballo, our guide, told us he had heard that a mysterious virus had swept through one village, that maybe it had spread. He said we should be patient. But he said we should also be prepared for the possibility that we'd be making the trek without company. We crashed across rivers and up cacti-lined ridges, over burro trails so faint that without Caballo, we almost certainly would never have found our way out. At 9 a.m., we arrived at a group of wooden and adobe one-story buildings huddled together at a riverbank. We were at the bottom of the Copper Canyon, 5,000 feet below the rim. The sun was up, and we were sweating profusely. Caballo suggested we wait, that maybe the Tarahumara would join us here. He warned us that they were incredibly shy, that we should not be too loud or aggressive if they showed up. We shouldn't try to shake their hands. Their greeting consisted of lightly touching fingertips, nothing more. He also mentioned that it would be good etiquette to bring gifts. He suggested Coca-Cola and Fanta sodas. I was appalled. I hadn't traveled the length of a country in order to bestow on an indigenous group of athletes plastic containers filled with high-fructose corn syrup. Why not just bring some blankets infested with smallpox? But Caballo insisted. We huddled in the shade of a little store, trying to stay cool as the sun beat down the deep canyon, holding on to our sweating bottles of Coke. Caballo suggested we start hiking up the trail, that maybe, or maybe not, our hosts would join us on the trail. No one saw them step out of the woods or around the bend. 1 minute, the trail was empty. The next, a group of 5 men in skirts and bright blouses were approaching. They had popped up like a herd of wild deer. We touched fingers and, without a word, started climbing 5,000 feet to the top of the canyon. Once we reached it, we would leave to descend again. Somewhere between 10 and 40 minutes later, no one was sure, there were 6 more Tarahumara with us. They appeared out of the woods, like smoke. One of the tribe seemed to be watching me with special interest. I was watching him, too. He looked stronger than the others, and there was something in his eyes. Pride, confidence, maybe even a little wariness that I recognized. I had it, too. His hair was jet black, and he had a movie cop's powerful jawline and muscles like a climbing rope. It was Arnulfo, the great Tarahumara champion, the swiftest of the running people. MacDougall had told me about him, and Caballo had told Arnulfo about me, that I was a great champion, too. We climbed in clusters of gringos and Indians, with Caballo leading us. We climbed through cacti and small brush, through desert oak and onto patches of arid, open land dotted with agave plants. During our brief stops, while Jen, Billy, Ted, and I took pulls from our water bottles, the Tarahumara fell to the ground, almost as if their calf tendons had been cut. The first time, I was shocked. Then I realized that they were resting, that it was a highly efficient way of conserving energy. I watched their feet as they climbed and saw that there, too, the Tarahumara moved without wasted motion. I was beginning to learn one of the secrets of this ancient tribe. It was the secret of efficiency. They carried no water bottles, but seemed to know every hidden seep in the wilderness. Whenever they were near one, they would quickly move toward it, bend down, take a few quick sips of water, then return to the trail. When we offered our gifts of Coke, they accepted the bottles without a word, guzzled the entire contents, then flung the empty containers to the side of the trail. It wasn't that they didn't care about the environment, they just didn't understand the notion of non-biodegradable. At the end of our canyon trek, we landed at a road, 5 miles from the village. There was the sheriff and his pickup truck. We Americans stood and looked. We didn't want to sully our spiritual day with a car. The Tarahumara immediately jumped in. It was efficient. The next 5 days, we got to know the Tarahumara. When we pulled out energy gels and bars, they laughed and chattered among themselves. They reached into their capes and pulled out pinole, roasted corn ground into a powder and mixed with water. It's their corn Gatorade. For food, they would carry tortillas with beans. Everything they ate was whole and pure. It was on that trip that I began to appreciate how much energy was packed into a single avocado. When we sat down to share meals, I also learned to sit at the end of the table where the guacamole would be set down. I would advise no one to get between a Tarahumara and a bowl of guacamole. I watched Arnulfo. He watched me. I had traveled here because the Tarahumara fascinated me, and I had some time. I looked at the trip as a learning vacation, but I was starting to get the idea that there was going to be nothing leisurely or just for fun about this race, especially not to the Tarahumara. I knew that I would go all out. It would be disrespectful to do anything less. The race started 5 days later at 8 a.m. As soon as it began, I realized what I had been suspecting ever since the Indians appeared from nowhere on the trail by the river. The guys I had raced at the Angeles Crest 100 were the Tarahumara B team. 3 of these guys launched themselves from the starting line as if they were running a 5K. They were in their 20s, and none of them were smoking. They carried no water, and if they had food, it was in the folds of their capes. I started out at a comfortable winning pace. I knew that no one could keep up the pace they were setting, especially in this 100-degree heat. 10 miles later, they were still keeping it up, but I wasn't worried. I knew what distance did to a man's body. I kept up my pace and ate, as usual, 200 to 300 calories per hour. I carried 2 bottles of water. I ate oranges and bananas. I also tried pinole at one of the aid stations. After 20 miles, I had passed 12 Tarahumara and was slightly surprised that there were still a few in front of me, 10 miles later, I was even more surprised. After 35 miles, hot, tired, and thirsty, when I realized there were 2 Tarahumara in front of me wearing robes and rubber sandals, I was not only surprised, I was amazed and worried. The leader was Arnulfo, wearing a deep crimson running shirt. I ran faster, until I was ticking off 7-minute miles. I have passed other ultra runners late in a race doing 7-minute miles. I have seen the looks in opponents' eyes when I sped past. I knew a move like that could break a man, but they were still ahead. I was a professional racer, trained almost year-round. I was at the height of my career. These guys had never heard of tempo runs or interval training. That's when it hit me. The real secret of the Tarahumara. They didn't prepare for runs. They didn't run to win or for medals. And they didn't eat so they could run. They ate and they ran to survive. To get someplace, they used their legs. To use their legs, they had to be healthy. The first great secret to the Tarahumara's endurance and speed and vigorous health was that running and eating were essential parts of their lives. The second great secret, one I try to remember every day, is that while the Tarahumara run to get from point to point, in the process they travel into a zone beyond geography and beyond even the 5 senses. They run and live with great efficiency, without a lot of needless thought. They don't reject technology in order to be fashionable or to make a political point. If technology is available and helps them lead a more efficient life, they embrace it. They'll jump into a pickup truck for transportation. They'll improve their huaraches with the rubber from discarded tires. It's exactly what I had been trying to do, to blend intuition with technology. Maybe it's presumptuous of me to describe what the Tarahumara probably don't articulate themselves, but when I was with them, I couldn't help but feel that they were experiencing a peace and a serenity that they, through running and through living with great simplicity, were able to access a state of being, a zone, a 6th sense, where they were in touch with the world in its purest form. It's the zone I had been seeking for so long. The Raramuri moved through the world with a form that could have come from a textbook. Their gait was fluid and economical. They took short strides, landing almost daintily on their mid to forefoot. There was no wasted side-to-side energy, and their posture was open in the shoulders, relaxed. The Tarahumara were later immortalized in MacDougall's book, Born to Run, where he called them super athletes. I would quibble with that. I would say they were super efficient. They were just much, much more in tune with their bodies and their surroundings. They knew things we had forgotten, with all of our stopwatches and sports foods and fancy running shoes. Spending a week with the Indians in Copper Canyon helped crystallize ideas that I had been thinking about since my first week at Team Berkey Ski Camp as a teenager. After my first race against the Tarahumara, Born to Run became a catchphrase and a credo for hundreds of thousands of people. As humans, we were meant to move swiftly over the earth. We knew how to run. If we could just return to that state of instinctive bliss, the theory went, we could re-embrace the form and ease we had abandoned and run free from pain, fatigue, and injury. Getting rid of our modern shoes was the suggested first step in this return to jogging Eden. It wasn't barefoot running that made the Tarahumara great runners, though. They wore huaraches. Form is what matters in running. Barefoot running can help you develop great form, but it's merely a means to an end. If you like running without shoes, great. If you prefer something on your feet, that's great too. I agree that modernity has brought with it a host of bad habits and disastrous unintended consequences, not only in running, an overdependence on heavily cushioned shoes being chief among them, and the sense that running is reserved for only a select few, but in eating too. Fast foods, mass production, grotesquely large servings, those by themselves have made us sick. Modernity has also brought us electricity, penicillin, and open-heart surgery, of course. Altogether, our modern inclination towards sloth, the easy availability of processed foods,